I'm Anna Sale, in for Leonard Lopate. And now, the man behind that terrifying and thrilling chase scene through the streets of 1970s New York. William Friedkin directed Gene Hackman in that famous scene where he's careening after an elevated subway after a criminal. He followed that film with The Exorcist. Both of those won Oscars and adoring audiences and changed what movie audiences and studios came to see as possible. By the time William Friedkin's next feature came out, Sorcerer, it was released alongside Star Wars, just as everything was changing again. He's out with a new book called The Friedkin Connection, about the twist of luck and self-inflicted trouble in his life in Hollywood. It's published by HarperCollins. Welcome to WNYC, William Friedkin.
Lovely to talk to you, Anna. Thank you.
Sure. Now let's start with The French Connection, because you're here in New York. And I want to ask you first, when you arrive in New York City and look around the streets, did your mind go back to those 1970s, those cold winter days when you were filming that movie?
No. The city has changed so much. But I have gone back to the locations where we shot The Chase and other locations, and they haven't changed much at all. Down near Coney Island, where The Chase began, and for about 26 blocks along Stillwell Avenue. Mm-hmm. And then I mixed the shots. I had my own version of New York City. I would make one shot in Queens. The car would turn right into a street in Brooklyn. And then the eventual home of it was under the L tracks on Stillwell Avenue. But I've gone back there because I did a documentary for the Blu-ray edition that came out a few years ago, where the producer and I showed the audience where we filmed this chase.
So The French Connection, let's first talk about the story, how you found out about the story of these two cops and what the process was in getting, you came up with, first with details, maybe you want to make a movie about this, but didn't have a script. How did you find out about this story, and how did it become a script that was going to get made into a movie?
My producer is a man named Phil D'Antoni. He found the story, and he brought it to me. And we were living in Los Angeles then. I went back to New York to meet the two actual cops who broke the case, Eddie Egan, who is now in that big precinct in the sky, mm-hmm. and Sonny Grasso, who is still with us. And I met them, and they were fascinating. They were really Mutt and Jeff characters, and I was attracted more to them as characters than to the French Connection story. So I really made the film about how they operated in the Narcotics Bureau, in the streets, and that happened in the 60s. We made the film in the 70s, but I didn't do it, period. I did it for the time in which we shot it. And my attraction was to them. And in those days, you weren't seeing a lot of cop films where the cops' behavior was often as bad as the bad guys. I think The French Connection and a film that came out the same year were the first to show that, and that was Dirty Harry. Dirty Harry was as bad as the guys he was going after.
And Gene Hackman was not your first choice for the role.
Right.
You write about in your book early conversations, and you cast him, and then you thought he was going to be in it. But tell me about Jimmy Breslin and why you thought he'd be a good fit for the role.
Well, the first guy I wanted was Jackie Gleason. And the head of the studio, which was Fox, said there's no way we're going to use Gleason. He had just made a film for Fox called Gigo. It was a silent movie about a clown, and it was the biggest disaster in the history of 20th Century Fox. So in 20 seconds, he said, no way. He said, by the way, you don't need a star for this picture. Just get a guy who's right for the part. I said, would you go with a non-actor? He said, yeah, if you think he's right. And this was music to my ears. I knew Jimmy Breslin very well. And I went to Jimmy. He was writing then for the New York Herald Tribune and then the Daily News. And I asked Jimmy if he'd be interested, and he said, you're nuts. He said, I can't act. I said, no, but you look exactly like the guy I want. So I rehearsed with him for a week, and on a Monday, he was brilliant. I had cast Roy Scheider, and I had Roy and Breslin working out routines together. On Tuesday, Jimmy was not quite so brilliant. Wednesday, he didn't show up. Thursday, he came in contrite. But I knew by then that I had to cut him loose. But since he was a friend, I didn't know how to. But he said to me, listen, there's a car chase in this movie, isn't there? I said, yeah. He said, well, I promised my mother on her deathbed that I would never drive a car, so I don't know how to drive. I said, you're fired. And that was it. He made it easy for me.
He made it easy for you. I also love the detail that he was interested in being in the movie initially as long as he didn't have to quit his day job.
Yes, I told him, look, you can write your columns. He had a column, I guess, 4 days a week. I said, you can write that anywhere. Write it from the set. I mean, you make all this stuff up anyway. And he was game, but it was a long shot that didn't work.
I'm speaking with William Friedkin, the director of The French Connection. Let's talk about the chase scene and how you put it together, how you figured out how it was going to work in the script, and then how you figured out you were going to film this on the streets of New York City.
The best chase I had seen then was Bullet. But on analysis, I didn't think Bullet was that great a chase. I thought the movie, and still think the movie, is terrific, Portrait of a San Francisco Detective. But for the chase in Bullet, they simply cleared the streets with permits and ran the cars over the hills. There was no danger to pedestrians. And I thought when I came to do The French Connection, I had to have a scene that was dangerous to innocent bystanders, because the New York streets everywhere are filled with people and cars and... So the producer and I, we didn't have a chase scene until a couple of weeks before we had to start shooting. And we made it a point to go out one day and start walking south from my apartment, which I was renting. It was up on 86th and Park. We started to walk, and we walked for 55 blocks, and we just let the city envelop us. And we started to spitball a chase scene. We felt the rumble of the subway between our feet. We saw people dodging traffic everywhere, guys speeding through intersections. We saw the smoke rising from the streets. And we gradually put together verbally a chase for the film. And I never storyboarded it. I never wrote it down. I had it in my head. And I knew that we were going to have to shoot the stuff with the car chasing the elevator train separately, and I wasn't going to get permission to do what I had in mind with the car.
I want to first mention, I love the detail in the book, that when you came up with the idea after those 55 blocks of walking, you shook hands and hugged.
That's true.
Because you knew you had it.
On an island in the middle of the street. Yes, that's it. We it off for weeks because we couldn't think of it.
And then how did you get the MTA on board? How are you gonna pull this off?
Well, I knew I probably needed permission to get on an elevated train. I found out that there were only two lines left at that time. There was Atlantic Avenue, I think, and Stillwell Avenue from Coney Island. And so we went to the guy who was the representative for the MTA. We told him what we had in mind. I asked him how fast an elevated train could go at top speed, because if it could go 100 miles an hour or so, the chase would have been impossible. He said, no, the top speed of an L train's 50 miles an hour. We said, great, this is wonderful. He said, why is it wonderful? I said, because this means we can do it. And he said, look, he said, that would be awfully difficult to give you permission to do something like this. I mean, almost impossible. So we thanked him. In my mind's eye, I thought, well, I'm just going to go steal it. I'll go up on various trains with my camera and stage the action and just do it. But so we thanked him, and we started to leave. And he said, just a minute, where are you going? You just said it's almost impossible to do it. He said, yeah, I said almost impossible. And D'Antoni, my producer, said, well, what would it take? And he said, $40,000 and a one-way ticket to Jamaica. And he didn't mean Queens. And I said, well, why a one-way ticket? He said, because if I let you do what you just told me you're going to do, and this film comes out, I will be fired. and I want to go retire in Jamaica. And that's what happened. The film came out. He was fired for giving us permission. And I hope he lived happily ever after.
Speaking of putting people's lives at risk, there's another story about post-production of The French Connection and trying to get just the right shotgun sound. And you are looking at what's available in terms of the stock sound, and you come across the gunshot sound from Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid. And it didn't work.
It didn't work because in those days, the studios kept their sound effects on what is known as optical track, which is how most films are still released, where the track is striped onto the edge of the picture. Optical track carries with it, before all of the systems to get rid of hiss and noise, optical track used to carry with it a loud hissing noise that was often as loud as the sound itself. So you'd have a gunshot, and before it you'd hear... It was impossible to take it out of context and use it. So I found out that one of our sound mixers had a shotgun, and I asked him to bring it into the Fox lot on a Sunday, and we started firing off this shotgun, and we got the sound very beautifully pristine on magnetic track, which is clean and has no hiss. And we started to mix it into the film because I wanted the gunshots to have extreme power. While we were mixing the track, the head of the studio, the head of production, came down in his golf clothes. It was a Sunday. He actually had golf shoes on. He was clicking around, and he was a tough guy. He looked like a Marine drill sergeant, and he acted like one. And he said, "What the hell are you guys doing? What's going on? I've had complaints from the neighbors around the Fox studio on Pico." He said, "You guys firing gunshots here?" We told him why. He said, "What are you talking about?" He said, "I recorded the shots for Butch Cassidy myself." And he said to the sound mixer, "Get those shots and play them for me." And the sound mixer brought out the stock shots that were used in Butch Cassidy. He heard the hiss. But he said to me, "Listen, those shots are good enough for Butch Cassidy, but not Bill Friedkin. You're crazy." And then we played for him what we recorded, and he stomped out because he knew we were right. We weren't shooting at anybody, but we were disturbing the peace on a Sunday morning of the neighborhood.
So that's just one example of the many times you did something that was nuts and dangerous and that the studio people would never want you to be doing.
I don't care.
You do it, and then there's a confrontation, and you win because it ends up working.
Well, I was right, and we weren't hurting anybody, and I didn't want to do it that way, but that was the only way. Because I had heard that the great film director, George Stevens, when he used gunshots in the movie Shane, he wanted them to sound louder. So he used the sound of a rifle instead of a .22, or instead of a six-shooter. And the sound of those gunshots was deafening. It was wonderful. And that's what I wanted to do for French Connection. That was the only way to get it.
So The French Connection wins Best Picture, Best Director, Best Actor for Gene Hackman, Best Adapted Screenplay. You talk about being at the Oscars that night, and along with all of those awards, you're on stage serenading Charlie Chaplin as he tearfully accepts an honorary Oscar. And then you write, "The next morning, I couldn't get out of bed. Not since the death of my mother could I remember feeling so depressed." What happened?
I thought it was too soon for me to win an Oscar. And I had profound depression. I went to a psychiatrist that was recommended by a friend. That's the only time, that one time that I went. I didn't enjoy the process. I knew that if you had a friend you could talk to, you didn't need a psychiatrist unless you were really, really screwed up. And I was just depressed because I didn't feel I deserved it.
Huh. So that was your last moment in psychiatry?
Yes. The guy listened to everything I said, and he was writing it all down on a yellow pad, and he never looked at me. So I started to lie to him. I'm not going to tell this total stranger how I really feel about stuff. I did that in my book.
Well, tell me about your book, because I'm curious. There are moments when you let us in an emotional window, and when you felt dark, when you felt like a failure, when you felt like your ambition led you to do things that you're not proud of now looking back. But a lot of the book focuses on choices, production choices, how we did this, how this happened. And do you think you're a man that enjoys self-reflection?
Not really, but once I was asked by 5 publishers to write a memoir, and I met with them all. When I decided I would do it with HarperCollins, I decided I wasn't going to lie. I wasn't going to cover up negative feelings I had or mistakes that I had made. Why put lies into a book? There are a lot of things I left out because the book is 500 pages. I did write a lot of other stuff, a lot of very personal things that had nothing to do with film, and I later cut those things. But my models for this autobiography was The Confessions of St. Augustine, mm-hmm. The Confessions of Jean-Jacques Rousseau, and Elia Kazan's autobiography, which is the best book about a filmmaker ever wrote about himself. And there, especially Augustine, is brutally frank. I mean, the man obviously achieved sainthood in his life, and he writes about what a mess he was and how sinful he was as a young person.
You quote St. Augustine when you're exploring the idea of why you're so drawn to dark material. You quote him saying he wants to suffer the pain given by being a spectator of these sufferings, and the pain itself is the pleasure. Do you think you uncovered somehow why it is that so many of your movies have dealt with the dark side of the human experience?
Yes, Anna, because what I really wanted to do when I became a film director was make MGM type of musicals. My favorite films outside of Citizen Kane are Bandwagon, Singin' in the Rain, Gigi, An American in Paris. But by the time I became a filmmaker, the Gershwins weren't writing anymore. Cole Porter wasn't writing. That kind of music wasn't the popular music of America anymore. There was no Fred Astaire, no Sid Charisse, no Gene Kelly, no Ann Miller. So I went to the dark side. It was an opening for me. But if I had my choice, I would have made the kind of films I just mentioned.
Even though your first film was a documentary about a man on death row?
Yes. I was motivated to make that film, not to become a filmmaker, but to save this man's life. And the film did save his life. He was going to the electric chair. He was an African-American in Chicago. And in those days when there was a crime that involved black people, the Chicago Police Department would go into the black community and round up the usual suspects. And I believe that they had beaten a confession out of this man and that he was innocent. And his last writ of certiorari before the Supreme Court of the United States was denied. And he was going to the chair when I accidentally found out about him and learned how to make a film on the job.
I'm speaking with Academy Award-winning director William Friedkin about his memoir, The Friedkin Connection. We have a lot more to cover, and we'll have more after a break. I'm Anna Sale, in for Leonard Lopate today. I'm speaking with film director William Friedkin about his career, making The French Connection, The Exorcist, and his new book, The Friedkin Connection. I first want to ask you, though, about The Boys in the Band, this movie that came out in 1970, this moment during, Stonewall had happened a year before. It's based on a play that went up in New York the year before Stonewall happened. How did you become the director of this film, which was about a group of gay men in late 60s New York?
Well, I had made a film just prior to that called The Birthday Party from a script by Harold Pinter. And before that, I did a film called The Night They Raided Minsky's in New York. And Mart Crowley, who wrote Boys in the Band, and Dominic Dunn, who was the producer, they saw those films. They wanted a young filmmaker who was acceptable to the studios at that time. And so they came to me, and I saw the play, and I thought it was incredibly wonderful. I saw it as a love story that had great humor and ultimately tragedy. It was an absolutely brilliant script. It was very timely, although its time was soon to pass, because gay people were coming out of the closet. And the guys and boys in the band were still in the closet. But that nevertheless didn't take away from the wonderful screenplay that Crowley wrote and the play.
You mentioned before the break that The People versus Paul Crump, your documentary about a man on death row, in part you made that because you saw it could have real implications in the real world for this man's life. When you decided to make The Boys in the Band, was it in some ways a political decision, or more that it just felt like the right project was coming along?
Not a political decision. I thought the characters were beautifully drawn. The dialogue was terrific. I wasn't concerned about making a statement about gay life. I thought that if there was a statement, it was inherent and didn't have to be underlined. I shot the film as a love story, which I felt that it was, and still do, but with great sense of humor. And that's what drew me to it.
So you make The Boys in the Band, then you make The French Connection, and then you make The Exorcist, which was based on a book. It was being shopped around Hollywood. You describe how a number of directors had passed on it, including Kubrick and Mike Nichols. And The French Connection hadn't come out when your name started floating up at the studios, and you were initially dismissed as sort of an art house guy.
Yes, or worse, you know. But no, I think the worst thing you could be considered in Hollywood is an art house guy, because I must remind you, Anna, that it's called show business, not show art. So my films were largely, at the time, not directed at the broad mass audience, and the studio wanted to go for that with The Exorcist.
And you talk about how you and the screenwriter eventually disagreed about what the meaning of that film was, whether it had enough of a moral center when you're dealing with things like the devil and demonic possession and good versus evil. How do you think about that disagreement now? Do you think you were right, or do you think there could have been a more sort of underscored message about good and evil in the Exorcist?
I restored the 12 minutes that I had originally taken out. Bill Blatty, the author, missed those 12 minutes because he felt they were the most apostolic moments of the film. I felt that the film did not need an apostolic underlining. Blatty is a devout Catholic. I'm not Catholic. I happen to be Jewish, but then so was Jesus. I mean, he was born, lived, and died a Jew, as we all know.
And you describe yourself as an agnostic, basically.
I define agnosticism as someone who believes that the power of God and the soul are unknowable. I don't deny the power of God or the soul. I don't know anything more than anybody else. So I'm not preaching to anybody. I have my own beliefs. I believe that the teachings of Jesus are wonderful, as are the teachings of Buddha and a number of other religions. But I don't belong to an organized religion. And so I felt we didn't need at the time to underline apostolic messages. I thought all of The Exorcist was a statement about the mystery of faith and belief. Blatty wanted to underline, and that still goes on between us. We talk two or three times a week. He lives in Bethesda. We still have these arguments, and every time I call him a sore winner. You know, the movie has made like $800 million around the world, which means everybody has seen it who can possibly see it. Most people have seen it twice. And the original version of it had 12 minutes out that Blatty believed were necessary to get people to not hate themselves for luxuriating in the demonic stuff. And I disagreed, and I prevailed at that time. In the year 2000, he asked me to consider putting it back in, and I felt that I owed him so much, that he did so much for me by literally handing this project to me, that I put it back in. And the film was just as successful when it was re-released.
After The Exorcist, a movie called The Sorcerer comes out, and it's released the week after Star Wars hits theaters, and it's not a success. And it begins this period in your book where you start using the word hubris a lot. You start talking about the ways that you undercut your relationships in Hollywood with some of the ways you behaved. And you talk about it with real regret. And so I wonder, as you think about what happened after Sorcerer and up until Bug and your latest films, which have gotten great critical success, there were several years there where it was difficult for you. Do you think that was because of yourself? Do you feel like it was because of the way you acted in Hollywood? Or is part of it that Hollywood moved beyond the kind of gritty, you know, adventurous movies, rebellious movies that you were making in the early 70s?
I think it's both. Certainly, as you say, Hollywood had moved beyond the kind of films I became known for into basically what's being made to this day. Comic books, video games, movies about vampires, werewolves, complete fantasy. And that seems to be what people want. But what I regret is that I often or sometimes treated people badly. That's what I found I regretted when I sat down to write this memoir. I didn't regret it at the time. I wasn't aware of it. Yes, I had taken on a veil of hubris and arrogance. I really did think I was bulletproof. And I was not, because there's a wonderful expression in Hollywood, and it's that those whom the gods would destroy, they first make successful in show business. And that happened to me. But I have to tell you that Sorcerer is coming back out into theaters this year. The world premiere is going to be at the Venice Film Festival on my birthday, August 29th, and it will then live in the digital world. It'll come out in theaters, on television, streaming, Blu-ray and DVD. After, I don't know how many years, it's coming back. So I can't feel bad about that. It's had a long voyage. I don't know how people will respond to it today. But at the time, it was not successful critically or at the box office, but I think I define success a little differently, Anna. Success to me is how close I came to my initial vision of it. That's all I can deal with. I can't let the critics decide my feelings about my own work or anyone else's. The critics can often be wrong. I do believe that audiences are less wrong. They know what they want. And that's what they want is what they should get. And my film, Sorcerer, then, was not what audiences wanted.
And it's coming back. It's fitting with the narrative. Your book ends on this. There's a lull, and there are chapters with things like the tunnel at the end of the light. And you describe hitting a low point when you were 55 years old. And then comes along Sherry,
yes.
And you fall in love. And this is after three failed marriages. You meet Sherry Lansing, who is a powerhouse producer in her own right, and making movies like Forrest Gump and the kinds of movies that the American public has been gravitating to in that phase of Hollywood. So it's do you see, like, looking back, do you feel that where you are in your life is this kind of shoulders down redemption, what you've learned over this period of after having that tunnel at the end of the light?
I wouldn't have changed a thing. And after I met Sherry, whose commercial instincts are far greater than my own, I haven't changed the kind of films I make. In fact, I've gone farther to the edge and farther to the dark side with Bug and Killer Joe.
They're dark.
Because they appealed to me. I understood them. Tracy Letts is a great writer, one of the best, if he's not the best American playwright now, He's way ahead of who's ever in second place, in my opinion. And we sort of have the same worldview. So I haven't tried to make films like Forrest Gump or Braveheart that Sherry greenlit. I think they're wonderful. She also greenlit The Titanic, which I don't think is wonderful. But it's one of the great successes of all time. I notice you're looking at the clock, so I do want to tell you about a very significant event that's happened. And today's the anniversary of that event, and it pertains not only to New York, but to the film industry. On this date, in 1941, Citizen Kane opened at the RKO Palace Theater.
How special I get to spend this day with you. Let's just take a few minutes and tell me about seeing Citizen Kane.
It's what made me want to become a filmmaker. Before that, I had only seen movies. Cartoons, serials, stupid, the Three Stooges.
In 1941, so you were a child.
I was 6 years old. I didn't obviously see it at the time it was made. I was trying desperately to graduate from kindergarten and go into the first grade, not doing all that well. But I saw it about 20 years later, maybe a couple of years later, and it was the work that set me on the path that has led me to this moment, sitting in front of the WNYC microphones with you. But for Citizen Kane, I would not have become a filmmaker. When I saw it, someone suggested I see it. I went into the theater at noon on a Saturday and stayed for the rest of the day. And I was just flabbergasted that someone could conceive of something like that and achieve it and realize it and so shake up the foundations of the world film industry. And I still feel that way about it. To me, it's like a Rembrandt painting or a piece of or Beethoven's Fifth Symphony.
I want to finish by asking you how you think about your ambition and what you call arrogance in some places in the book. You say that to become a director, you must have ambition, luck, and the grace of God. Talent counts, but without luck and ambition, opportunities won't occur. There's so many moments where you sort of say, I don't know if I would have done it that way, or I put people's lives at risk when I was making the French Connection, but you made the French Connection. So I wonder, when you think of that part of you that drove you to do the things you did in Hollywood and to make the movies you did and to take on the studios, do you feel good about that ambition at this point in your life?
Yes. That was me then. I can't deny that. That was who I was. I can regret it. I wouldn't do it again that way.
All right. I've been speaking with William Friedkin, director of The French Connection and The Exorcist. His book is called The Friedkin Connection. It's published by HarperCollins. William Friedkin will be taking part in a series of Q&As, first on May 2nd at BAM. More information on our show page at WNYC.org. William Friedkin, thank you so much.
My pleasure.